Tax season has arrived, and doing taxes without the right help can feel overwhelming. Intuit TurboTax is here now to guide you through it with confidence. Match with a TurboTax full-service expert who handles everything for you from start to finish. Your dedicated expert checks every single deduction and credit to help you get the best possible outcome so you can feel confident you're getting every dollar you deserve. And the best part? You'll see real-time updates on your expert's progress right on your phone while you live your life. Plus, you get unlimited expert help at no extra cost, even on nights and weekends during tax season. Visit TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax full service experts. Real-time updates only on iOS mobile app.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more
Moto
details.
Moto Casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hey, everybody, you're about to listen to our brand new podcast, Nightmare Neighbors. And if you like it, please do me a favor. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. In exchange for that, I'm going to put you into a drawing for a $250 Amazon gift certificate, gift card, whatever you want to call it, gift credit, whatever it is these days. Anyway, all you have to do is leave that review on Apple Podcasts. Send me the screenshot. Send it to Tony@nightmareneighbors.com. And then shortly, I'll be picking one person at random and sending you that Amazon gift card for $250. Yes, just leave the review, Apple Podcasts. That's what helps spread the word that this show exists, that people know about it. Those reviews are tremendously helpful in us getting this show off the ground. So if you like it, please leave us that review on Apple Podcasts. Send me the screenshot to Tony@nightmareneighbors.com, and you'll be in the drawing for that Amazon gift card. I hope you like the show. I hope you can take the 30 seconds to leave the review and get yourself in that drawing for that gift certificate. Now, without further ado, Nightmare Neighbors, everybody. When a patient is in the care of hospital staff, they expect safety and the best treatment possible. As we know, that's not always the case, especially if you are in the care of Charles Edmund Cullen. Over the years, the dark mind of Charles would steal the lives of up to 40 different patients in his care. How did his spree go on so long? And how did it end for Charles Cullen?
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Charles Edmund Cullen, born February 22nd, 1960, is American serial killer who confessed to murdering up to 40 patients during his 16-year career as a nurse in New Jersey. However, in subsequent interviews with police, psychiatrists, and journalists, it became apparent that he had killed many more whom he could not specifically remember by name, though he could often remember details of their murders. Experts have estimated that Cullen may ultimately be responsible for up to 400 deaths, which would make him the most prolific serial killer in recorded history. Charles Cullen was born in West Orange, New Jersey, to a working-class Irish Catholic family. The last of eight children, his father, Edmund, a bus driver, was 56 when he was born and died on September 17, 1960, when he was just 7 months old. Cullen had described his childhood as miserable and being constantly bullied by his sister's boyfriends and his schoolmates. When he was nine, he made the first of many suicide attempts by drinking chemicals from a chemistry set. Later, while working as a nurse, Cullen claimed to have fantasized about stealing drugs from the hospital where he worked and using them to end his life. Cullen's mother, Florence, was killed in a car accident on December 6, 1977, when he was a junior in high school. He recalled her death as being devastating and being upset that the hospital would not return her body, instead having it cremated. The following year, he dropped out of high school and enlisted in the U.S. Navy, where he served abroad on the submarine, the USS Woodrow Wilson. Cullen successfully passed basic training and the rigorous psychological examinations required for submarine crews, who are expected to spend as long as 2 months at a time underwater in a cramped vessel. Cullen rose to the rank of Petty Officer Second Class as part of the team that operated the ship's Poseidon missiles. He did not fit in any better in the Navy and was hazed and bullied by his fellow crewmen. A year into his service, Cullen's leading petty officer on the Woodrow Wilson discovered him seated at the controls for the missiles, wearing a surgical mask, gloves, and scrubs rather than his uniform. Cullen was disciplined for this action, but never explained why he dressed the way he did. The Navy made the decision to reassign Cullen to a less high-pressure job on the supply ship USS Canopus. He attempted suicide and was committed to the Navy psychiatric ward several times over the next few years. Cullen received a medical discharge from the Navy in 1984 for reasons that have not been disclosed. Shortly after, he enrolled in the Mountainside Hospital School of Nursing in Montclair, New Jersey. Elected president for his nursing class, he graduated in 1986 and started work at the burn unit of St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston. During this time, he met and married his wife, Adrienne Baum. Their daughter, Shauna, was born later that year. Cullen's wife became increasingly disturbed at his unusual behavior and abuse of the family dogs. And that's where things begin to turn even darker for Charles Cullen. So it sounds like kind of a bad recipe to begin with. Tony and Sean joining you on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia as we dig into the world of Charles Cullen, possibly one of the, if not the worst serial killer in history, possibly more than 400 dead on record, far fewer than that. But my God, at what point or at what area of, you know, the job hiring process, the interview process, do you not look at the history and go, maybe this person shouldn't be in charge of other people's health, you know?
Okay, Charles, have a seat here. My name is Larry. Me and Danielle are going to be a part of the hiring crew here at the medical center. I see here you tried to kill yourself 9 times. Okay, we'd like to schedule a second interview. Here's the thing. In all seriousness, a few things that stood out. The youngest of 8 kids. I am the youngest of 3 children. Mm-hmm. And in no way, shape, or form have I even thought of killing another human or myself. But mm-hmm. I will say there is a stigma associated with being the youngest.
Sure.
Where you can now, obviously, your upbringing and the folks that you have in your life and being bullied or not. But there is a certain sense of need to garner attention. Mm-hmm. Some people do it playing sports. Some people immerse themselves in music. Others try to kill themselves. Clearly something is not right with this gentleman, but man, to have a parent pass away when he's less than a year old, I mean, his mom dies in a car accident. That is not a good hand dealt by the world. You lose both your parents before you're 18 years old.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's one of those things where he had a lot of things working against him, unfortunately. And then to try and make sense of it, to try and make a sane, decent life out of it, you know, it's certainly an uphill climb. And some are able to do that, and some are able to move past the shitty cards that life deals you, and others, unfortunately, fall victim to them. And that's in no way to make an excuse for what he did by any means, but you can certainly kind of understand something didn't click right here. We have mental illness. We have a ton of trauma. We have a lot of this horrible recipe that ended up creating this individual that we're...
What is so dang interesting and frustrating, if you're tuning in and you're having issues in the job hunt, maybe you were affected by the COVID conditions and you're applying for new jobs. Even this guy gets hired as a nurse when you get passed up. Even this guy gets married and finds a wife and is lucky enough to bring a child into the world. WTF.
Are you trying to make people more depressed with that statement, or are you trying to encourage people? I'm not quite sure. If you're like,
it was a very poorly timed, maybe an attempt at a joke. Basically, it's just, hey, guess what? That automated HR email that you just got, the reply of that job you really, really wanted and you were super qualified for. It's okay. It's okay. You didn't kill 400 people. You know, that's good.
Even Charles Cullen could get a job. Even he could get a wife and have a child. What does that say for you?
Even he wasn't allergic to dogs that he would later then abuse. You are a worthless piece of shit. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to our uplifting podcast today. It's called The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Let's continue on with the world and the life of Charles Cullen. Cullen's first confessed murders occurred at St. Barnabas on June 11, 1988. He administered a lethal overdose of intravenous medication to a patient. He admitted to killing several other patients at St. Barnabas, including an AIDS patient who died after being given an overdose of insulin. Cullen left St. Barnabas in January 1992 when hospital authorities began investigating who had contaminated IV bags. The investigation determined that Cullen was most likely responsible, resulting in dozens of patient deaths at the hospital. 1 month after leaving St. Barnabas, Cullen took a job at Warren Hospital in Phillipsburg, where he murdered three elderly women by giving them overdoses of the heart medication Digoxin. His final victim said that a sneaky male nurse had injected her as she slept, but family members and healthcare providers at the hospital dismissed her comments as unfounded. The following year, Cullen moved into a basement apartment in Phillipsburg following a contentious divorce from his wife. He shared custody of his daughters. He would later claim that he wanted to quit nursing in 1993, but the court-ordered child support payments forced him to continue working. In March of 1993, Cullen broke into a co-worker's home while she and her son slept, but left without waking them. He then began stalking the woman, who filed a police report against him. Cullen subsequently pleaded guilty to trespassing and received 1 year of probation. The day after his arrest, Cullen attempted suicide again. He took 2 months off of work and was treated for depression in two psychiatric facilities, but attempted suicide twice more before the end of 1993. That September, a 91-year-old cancer patient reported that Cullen, who was not her assigned nurse, had come into her room and injected her with a needle. She died the next day. Her son protested that her death was non-natural, and Warren Hospital administered lie detector tests to Cullen and several other nurses, which he passed. He continued to work at Warren until leaving the following spring. Cullen began a 3-year stint in the intensive care cardiac care unit of Hunterdon Medical Center in Flemington. He claimed that he did not harm anyone during the first 2 years, but hospital records from that time period had been destroyed by the time he was arrested in 2003. Cullen did admit to murdering 5 patients between January and September of 1996, again with overdoses of drugs. He then found work at Morristown Memorial Hospital, but was soon fired for poor performance. Cullen remained unemployed for 6 months and stopped making child support payments. After seeking treatment for depression in the Warren Hospital emergency room, Cullen was admitted to a psychiatric facility, but left a short time later. In February 1998, Cullen was hired by the Liberty Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where he staffed a ward of respirator-dependent patients. There, Cullen was accused of giving patients drugs at unscheduled times and was fired after being seen entering a patient's room with syringes in his hand. The patients ended up with a broken arm, but apparently received no injections. Cullen caused a patient's death at Liberty Hospital, which was blamed on another nurse. After leaving Liberty, Cullen was employed at Easton Hospital in Easton, Pennsylvania from November 1998 to March 1999. On December 30, 1998, he murdered yet another patient with drugs. The coroner's blood test showed lethal amounts of digoxin in the patient's blood, but an internal investigation within Easton Hospital was inconclusive. Nothing pointed definitively to Cullen as the murderer. Even with his history of mental instability and the number of deaths during his employment at various hospitals, Cullen continued to find work due to a national shortage of nurses. Additionally, no reporting mechanism existed at the time to identify nurses with mental health or employment problems at hospitals. Concerned about liability, were unwilling to take significant actions against Cullen. So I think we'll pause there because the story does certainly continue, but that's a lot to digest in one big chunk. And it did answer some of my questions of how the hell does he keep getting hired? This is the 90s. The internets are a-flowin'. The AOL is a-rockin'. You can find information on people. And in such a sensitive area of employment as healthcare, there's no record keeping. There's no way of cross-referencing someone that comes from this hospital to that hospital and has a string of mysterious deaths attached to it. There's probably better background checks going on at the bowling alley for the person who's spraying the size shoes you're wanting and giving them to you at the counter than what was happening in our medical system at the time, allowing this man to do what he did. It's insane and shocking just knowing how not far back in history this is. What are your thoughts?
I'd like to think if you are in an interviewing room and he's there, that if your speakers are loud enough and you're online, you'll hear the, "You've got mail." And then you look, and it is the background of him. Mm-hmm. Something, some dots were connected. From afar, and being reading about this now decades later, you'd like to think that there'd be an aha moment or a well duh or common sense or somebody was talking to somebody, but man, when there are millions of healthcare workers and there is a need and there is a job, and if somebody appears to be semi-sane on the outside, like, it's sad, but I'm not entirely shocked that he could get so many jobs.
Oh, that's scary.
It's very scary, and I just knock on a little wood here to make sure that I continue in good health and not have to be at the mercy of some hospitals. I will say that I would like to think, or you would think that major market medical institutions, bigger, more people, higher population, mm-hmm. maybe there's more of a HR protocol, interviews and such. They seem to be more rural, smaller medical centers. And because there was such a need, you hear often in the teaching industry, if you're a male, you have a little bit easier of a route to be maybe an elementary school teacher. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of male nurses, and I would imagine even less back then. So, yeah, I mean, he allegedly killed someone, but hey, he's a nurse.
Not someone, it's like multiple people at each building.
He doesn't eat people's food out of the staff kitchen.
God, I would think, even if HR is not catching this, if you were a coworker of this guy, I mean, hell, I'm thinking back to the late 90s now. I'm thinking back to my time working in radio in the late 90s. There's people to this day that I remember that were just
weird and awkward and did strange things, and I suspected, you know, maybe serial killers on the side or something. I guess not like seriously, but you really kind of wondered that, you know, to this day, I somewhat Facebook stalk to see what they're up to. You know, what sort of weird, crazy shit have they done? I would imagine back then, although there was no social media at the time, you would have had coworkers who would be like, oh, remember that guy? I wonder what he's doing now. And you constantly, you know, through the grapevine prior to social media heard, oh, he bounced from here, he bounced from there. And you would wonder if amongst coworkers and staff, there would have been kind of rumblings of, yeah, he's over there now after all those people, you know, all those mysterious deaths here and there, that didn't rumble loud enough for anybody to say, maybe we should really, you know, put the brakes on hiring this guy wherever he applies or do a little more investigating. I don't know. I mean, it just seems insane that you can have all these mysterious deaths or be suspected of infecting IV bags in mass quantity, but we can't quite prove it. So, well, worst case, you're going to get a job at the hospital on the other side of town. It's just like, what the fuck? This isn't like this. This sounds to me like a story that would have taken place in the 1920s or 1930s, not 1998. You know, back where you could kind of jump town to town and create a whole new identity for yourself, and they just believe you. This does not sound like it. I guess we just have this level of faith, or I have this level of faith of how our society runs and how institutions run, that once, you know, push comes to shove, you find out, oh, the grown-ups really aren't manning the store after all. And it's a scary thought.
What I find interesting is, and maybe it's just the technology and stuff that has become a lot harder to pass, but the 91-year-old patient that apparently he killed, which, man, what a run. You make 91 years on Earth, mm-hmm. and then you succumb to this this human. He passed a lie detector test,
yeah.
which that then calls into question of who read that. Did he, in fact, how does one pass a lie detector test, and how that was not? So it seems as though that he absolutely fell through the cracks.
Yeah.
And what's also interesting is back when he was court ordered with child support, not to say that many lives could have been saved, but quite honestly, many lives could have been saved if he was not forced to go back to work with child support payments
mm-hmm.
and continued his ways.
Yeah. I guess my other question, and I don't think we're going to find the details of it in this entry, but and suicide is something that I would never say, hey, this is a great idea for really anyone. But someone like this, who's actively killing people and has kind of made it their side hobby or their side gig, how do you fail so badly at that many times? You know, it's like you can't even pull that one off. But a lot of times it's a cry for help, if you will, or something of that nature. But you know, clearly this is a very disturbed individual, and the world would have been better off had he been successful at it. In this case, this individual, there's no place in the world for someone to be doing these sort of things, and the world would have been better off.
How can you be so good
at
taking other lives?
But you can't do your own.
You had one job.
Yeah.
You just take care of you.
Yeah. I don't know. Let's continue on the magical world of Charles Cullen. In March of 1999, Cullen took a job at the burn unit of Allentown's Lee Valley Hospital, where he murdered one patient and attempted to murder another. 1 month later, he voluntarily resigned from Lee Valley Hospital and took a job working at the cardiac care unit at St. Luke's Hospital in Bethlehem. Within the next 3 years, Cullen murdered at least five patients and is known to have attempted to kill two more. On January 11th of 2000, he once again attempted suicide by lighting a charcoal grill in his bathtub, hoping to succumb to carbon monoxide poisoning. Cullen's neighbors smelled smoke and called the fire department and police. He was taken to a hospital and psychiatric facility, but returned home the following day. No one suspected Cullen was murdering patients at St. Luke's until a coworker found vials of medication in a disposable bin. The drugs were not valuable outside the hospital and were not used by recreational drug users, so their theft seems uncurious. An investigation showed that Cullen had taken the medication. He was offered a deal by the medical facility, resign and be given a neutral recommendation, or be fired. He resigned and was escorted from the building in June of 2002. Seven of his co-workers at St. Luke's later alerted the Lee County District Attorney about their suspicions that Cullen had used drugs to kill patients. Investigators never looked into Cullen's past, and the case was dropped 9 months later due to lack of evidence. In September of 2002, Cullen began working in the critical care unit of the Somerset Medical Center in Somerville, New Jersey. He began dating a local woman around this time, but his depression worsened. Cullen killed around 13 patients and attempted to kill at least one more by mid-2003, using his drug of choice, digoxin insulin. On June 18, 2003, Cullen unsuccessfully attempted to murder Somerset patient Philip Greger, who was later discharged. He died 6 months later of natural causes. Soon afterwards, Somerset began to notice clues indicating Cullen's wrongdoing. The hospital's computer system showed that Cullen was accessing the records of patients whom he was not assigned. Co-workers began seeing him in the rooms of patients to whom he was not assigned, and the hospital's computerized drug dispensing cabinet showed that he was requesting medications that his patients had not been prescribed. Cullen's drug requests were strange, with many orders that were immediately canceled and many repetitive requests within minutes of each other. In July 2003, the executive director of the New Jersey Poison Information and Education System warned Somerset officials that at least four suspicious overdoses indicated the possibility that an employee was killing patients. The hospital delayed contacting authorities until October. By then, Cullen had killed at least another five patients and attempted to kill a sixth. When a patient in Somerset died of low blood sugar in October of 2003, the hospital alerted the New Jersey State Police. That patient was Cullen's final victim. State officials castigated the hospital for failing to report a non-fatal insulin overdose administered by Cullen in August. An investigation into his employment history revealed past suspicions about his involvement with prior deaths. Somerset fired Cullen on October 31st of 2003. Relying on his job application. Fellow nurse Amy Lauren alerted the police after becoming alarmed about Cullen's record of accessing drugs and links to patient deaths. Police kept him under surveillance for several weeks until they had finished their investigation. Investigators assigned Lauren to visit Cullen after work hours and talk with him while wearing a wire. From this, they were able to produce enough evidence for probable cause of arrest. Arrest and sentencing Cullen happened at a restaurant. On December 12, 2003, he was charged with one count of murder and one count of attempted murder. On December 14th, he admitted to homicide detectives Dan Baldwin and Tim Brown that he had murdered Reverend Florin Gall and attempted to murder Jing Kong Han, both patients at Somerset. In addition, Cullen told the detectives he had murdered as many as 40 patients over his 16-year career. In April of 2004, Cullen pled guilty in a New Jersey court to killing 13 patients and attempting to kill two others by lethal injection while employed at Somerset. As part of his plea agreement, Cullen promised to cooperate with authorities if they did not seek the death penalty for his crimes. A month later, he pled guilty to the murder of three more patients in New Jersey. In November of 2004, Cullen pled guilty in an Allentown court to killing six patients and trying to kill three others. He repeatedly interrupted the proceedings by taunting the judge with the chant, "Your Honor, you need to step down." Cullen was ordered to be restrained and gagged. On March 2, 2006, Cullen was sentenced to 11 consecutive life sentences in New Jersey and is not eligible for parole until the year 2403. Currently, he is held at New Jersey State Prison in Trenton. On March 10, 2006, Cullen was brought into the courtroom of Lee County President Judge William H. Platt for a sentencing hearing. Cullen, upset with the judge, kept repeating, "Your Honor, you need to step down," for 30 minutes until Platt and Cullen gagged with cloth and duct tape. Even after being gagged, Cullen continued to try to repeat the phrase. In this hearing, Flatt gave him an additional 6 life sentences. As part of his plea agreement, Cullen had been working with the law enforcement officials to identify additional victims. So it just keeps going. And it just keeps going. And it really seems, it's almost like technology saved the day on this one. It was a computer system that had put the red light out and said, this person is getting drugs that are not on the list of this person to be getting drugs for. Maybe we should do something. And even then, when the humans that are supposed to be the fail-safe, that realize that the computer's telling them this, still it's like, well, maybe we should just reassign you. It almost reminds me of like the Catholic Church and moving around child molesters. And it makes me wonder to a certain extent, if the hospitals in this case didn't want, you know, the bad rep or the bad story. Because if this comes out that you have someone at your hospital that's doing these horrific things, because you investigated it and you came to these conclusions, that certainly puts a bad stamp on your hospital. I wonder, go ahead.
And depending upon the patient in question, is this person going to die anyways? This is a hospital. People die.
Sure.
It's the spotlight is shined a different angle, because obviously reading this and knowing that this person was clearly suffering some issues and absolutely tragic how many people lost their lives, but you flip it and you flip it into medical centers and hospitals. They are for-profit institutions. Mm-hmm. Bottom line. Hundreds, thousands of healthcare workers. And what's interesting is they found out about it in July 2003, and then the hospital delayed contacting authorities until October. So that's 3 months of knowing that there is somebody on staff who is killing patients. And that wasn't the red button that's covered by the glass next to the fire alarm. That wasn't pressed for 3 whole months.
Well, I mean, it even goes deeper than that. It goes like 10 years or longer, 16 years of his career, because he has all of these hospitals that end up, he gets fired or quits from, and all of them have all these suspicious deaths, and nobody's like, maybe we should contact the authorities and say, let's dig into this a little bit deeper. I mean, there were so many red flags left and right, but then if you do raise that red flag and go, hey, we need the authorities to come in here and look at this, if they find something, yeah, your hospital is on the line too. I mean, yes, that individual would be certainly caught, but then you are going to be the recipient of lawsuits from every single person who died by this individual's hand. And I'm wondering how much of that played into the decisions at some of these hospitals not to dig into this deeper, but just kind of brush this person away. And I don't know if I'm misinterpreting that, but that sure seems to be what went on, at least from my perspective as a layperson who's not involved in that industry. But it's just shocking that he could keep bouncing around the way he did.
And what would be interesting to go back into the records to see who was the CEO, to see who was the president of these healthcare systems that I would imagine back in the early 2000s, late 90s, it's not where everything is consolidated current day, but to see who was the decision maker and to see where they are current day and to reach out and say, Sue, clearly they won't answer, or there will be some PR talk, but why didn't this take place in 1992 when you could have done this, when you noticed this?
It'd be very interesting to dig into and try and get some answers. It would certainly take some time, but that in itself, this would be a very interesting case to jump into almost as a serial type podcast. And because there's so many elements to it and take a lot of digging and time. And I wish I had more time in my life, but I don't. But it certainly is an interesting case. Let's continue on as we dig more into the chapter on Charles Cullen in Wikipedia about his motive for what he did. Cullen stated he administered overdoses to patients in order to spare them from being coded, going into cardiac or respiratory arrest and being listed as code blue emergency. He told detectives that he could not bear witness or hear about attempts at saving a victim's life. Cullen also stated he gave patients overdoses so that he could end their suffering and prevent hospital personnel from dehumanizing them. However, not all of his victims were terminal patients. Some, like Gall, had been expected to recover before Cullen killed them. Nurse Lynn Tester described many of the victims as people on the mend in a police interview. Instead of using common painkillers and stimulants, access of which was strictly regulated by hospitals due to their value as street drugs, Cullen chose instead to use his tools of choice, drugs of digoxin and insulin, which had little use outside of a hospital setting and were less likely to attract attention. Investigators stated that Cullen may have caused patients to suffer, but that he appears not to realize this, contradicting his claims of wanting to save patients. Similarly, Cullen told investigators that although he often observed patients suffering for several days, the decision to commit each murder was performed on impulse. Cullen told detectives in December of 2003 that he lived most of his life in a fog and that he had blacked out memories of murdering most of his victims. He said he could not recall how many he killed or why he had chosen them. In some cases, Cullen adamantly denied committing any murders at a given facility, but after reviewing medical records, he admitted that he was involved in patients' deaths. Cullen was largely able to move from facility to facility undetected because of the lack of requirements to report on suspicious behavior by medical workers and inadequate legal protection for employers. New Jersey and Pennsylvania, like most states, required healthcare facilities to report suspicious deaths only in the most egregious cases, and penalties for failing to report incidents were minor. Many states did not give investigators the legal authority to discover where a worker had previously been employed. Employers feared to investigate incidents or give a bad employment reference for fear that such actions might trigger a lawsuit. According to detectives and Cullen himself, several hospitals suspected he was harming or killing patients but failed to take appropriate legal actions. Following Cullen's criminal conviction, many of the hospitals where he had worked were sued by families of his victims. The files and settlements against the New Jersey hospitals all settled out of court are sealed. In some cases, individual workers took it upon themselves to informally try to prevent Cullen from being hired or to have him terminated. Some contacted nearby hospitals in secret or quietly spoke to their own supervisors to alert them that they should not hire Cullen. When Cullen took a job at Sacred Heart Hospital in Allentown in June of 2001, a nurse who had heard rumors about him at Easton Hospital advised her co-workers. They threatened to quit en masse if Cullen was not immediately dismissed, which he was. Prompted by the Cullen case, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and 35 other states adopted new laws which encourage employers to give honest appraisals of workers' job performance, which gave employers legal protections when they provide a truthful employee appraisal. The New Jersey laws in particular formed a model that the rest of the states would follow. First, in 2004, the Patient Safety Act increased hospitals' responsibility for reporting serious preventable adverse events. The 2005 Enhancement Act was a supplement to the Patient Safety Act and required hospitals to report certain details about their employees to the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs. It also mandated that complaints and disciplinary records related to patient care be kept for at least 7 years. So a lot of what we were suspecting there and a lot of what I was guessing at indeed was the case of why they were not reporting. But it turns out that now these things are in place. I guess it's just shocking to me that these things occurred in like 2005, which I know is like 15 years ago, but to a lot of us seems like yesterday. These events, these safeguards happened in a post 9/11 world. These safeguards against these type of employees happened after 9/11. And to all of us who lived through that, there's like pre-9/11 and post-9/11. And this just seems like it would have been very much a pre-9/11 thing as far as getting this shit in order. This seems like stuff that would have been put in order in like at least the 60s or 70s or 30s or 40s, not 2005. But unfortunately, 2005 is when it finally caught up and somebody said, maybe we should check these people that were ensuring the lives of others around. Holy shit.
Definitely doesn't make you feel comfortable to, well, I mean, excuse me, current day, absolutely.
Yeah.
To feel comfortable going into a medical facility. But you think back to more than 15 years, that's 15 years ago. That's not that long ago.
No.
That prior to that, anything, any surgery, I mean, maybe you're alive today and you think to yourself, man, that knee replacement back in 97, you know, my knee just, it feels like there's a pair of pliers in my knee. Well, I got to hand it to you, Uncle Jack. There may be, because guess what? It was not required by Johnson Medical Center to report that Dr. Knox was hammered when he was opening up your knee. Yeah, that's very interesting. And there is probably more stringent laws requiring how a toaster oven was made by Black & Decker in 1987 than the nurse saving your life, or hopefully not killing you. That's very interesting, and that is very eye-opening. That I did not know that.
The safeguards.
As recent as 15 years ago, hospitals are now legally forced to, or from what it sounds like, legally protected, that if they're honest about an employee, that they're not going to get sued.
Yeah, that seems to be what it is. It makes sense. I don't want to say I understand, like, oh yeah, of course, that's why you wouldn't do that, because it's completely immoral to not report these sort of things. But when you look at it from how a business runs itself, not from a moral standpoint, but from a business standpoint of not wanting to go out of business and not getting sued, that's why they didn't report. It's not right, but that's why. So hopefully with what's in place now, those sort of things can be prevented. It really makes you wonder, because I think we kind of grow up and we have this idyllic sense of safeguards that are in place. And then we look back years later and go, oh my God, I can't believe that they were allowed to do that, or we were allowed to do this or that, in all different aspects of life. And it makes you wonder right now, when we look back in our world of 2020, take COVID out of the equation, and we're just talking about life in general and things that we do or we let our kids do, what are we going to look back on in 20, 30 years from now and go, holy shit, I can't believe we were allowed to do that, or we allowed people to do that because it was so dangerous, but we didn't see it. I mean, this one seems pretty obvious, like this was insanely dangerous. You would have recognized it back then. But what sort of things are in place out there or not in place out there that should be, that allow just kind of madness to go on until something like this finally comes to a head? Unfortunately, I don't think we realize it until it gets there. It's hard to identify these things in some ways, shapes, or forms. And I don't know why this was so hard to identify. It really, it came down to the employees in many cases standing up and really kind of doing the mutiny thing of, we're all going to quit if you don't fire this person. We know the law's not on your side, but we're all going to leave. And, you know, God bless them for doing that. But that's just, scary and crazy that that's what it took.
It makes me thankful for that nurse or nurses that may very well now give me the comfort that when I go to the hospital, I'll know truthfully and honestly who's taking care of me.
Yeah, it really does. There you go. That's the story of Charles Cullen on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, press subscribe wherever you listen to us on. Leave us a review out there on Apple Podcasts. You'll be in a drawing for a $200 Amazon gift card. We will randomly pick someone very soon to give that to. So be sure to leave that review and then send it to me. Send it to Tony, T-O-N-Y, at realghoststoriesonline.com. That'll be the email you can send that to for this round. We'll get you into the drawing for that gift certificate. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
When I first heard the words, you have lung cancer, I was in shock.
This week on a special episode of Health Discovered, we're taking a closer look at a common form of lung cancer that accounts for 85% of all cases.
I'm Janet Freeman Daly, and I've been living with non-small cell lung cancer since 2011.
Non-small cell lung cancer. It's a diagnosis that changes everything. And yet, the conversation around it too often stops at the biology and misses what patients are actually living through every single day.
There are some things you used to be able to do that you can't do anymore. It's easy to become depressed when you're dealing with all those losses. So mental health plays a really big role.
So what does it really mean to advocate for yourself when you're living with non-small cell lung cancer? Listen to Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social.
John Daly here. You know what day it is?
Neither do I.
I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily.
And the best part?
Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino.
Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's the truth. You could literally be adored by everyone and then come home and still get completely ignored by your own cat. It's classic cat behavior. But new Shiba Premium Puree is a lickable treat that changes all that. They're protein-rich, made with bone broth, and have the smooth, creamy texture cats go crazy for, especially when it's hand-fed. Yeah, it's more than a treat. It's a fast pass to favorite human status. So feed your cat Sheba and go from totally ignored to truly adored in just 12 days, guaranteed, or your money back. Learn more at Sheba.com.